The visionary climax, dying away in those luminous alleluias, somehow suggesting consolation for the living, peace for the dead, and ending, as Howells himself wrote, in complete tranquility. His Hymnus Parasidi has just received its first BBC promised performance here in the Royal Albert Hall, and live, of course, on Radio 3. The soprano soloist Mia Pearson and the tenor Andrew Kennedy, with the BBC Symphony Chorus, Chorus Master Stephen Jackson, the London Philharmonic Choir, Chorus Master Neville Creed, and the BBC Symphony Orchestra. The conductor was Martin Brabbins. Have to mention the Albert Hall organ. Those bass notes go straight through your feet. It's quite extraordinary in this building. And Malcolm Hicks, I'm assured, was doing triple stopping on the pedals. He must have extraordinarily flexible feet. Scores inscribed to my son, Michael Kendrick Howells, in remembrance. But Callum MacDonald in tonight's programme notes suggest Howells' final spur to complete the work may have been the death of his close friend, composer and poet Ivor Gurney, both Gloucestershire men, students together at the Royal College. Howells, one of the few to visit Gurney in mental hospital, and Gurney buried in the same Gloucestershire graveyard as Michael, in fact, next to him. Back onto the platform, Mia Pearson and Andrew Kennedy. Andrew Kennedy, something of an Ivor Gurney specialist, hoping to record some newly discovered, if you like, songs of his in the near future. And he says he feels that Howells felt some guilt at his own success while Gurney's life was destroyed. Onto the platform, the two chorus masters, Stephen Jackson and Neville Creed. Martin Brabbins was suggesting at rehearsal this afternoon that the two were playing good cop and bad cop. One going for the jugular while the other massaged the egos. Back onto the podium, Martin Brabbins. It was the turning point of Howells' career, this piece. After it, his music is almost entirely choral. Martin Brabbins brings the BBC Symphony Orchestra to its feet. And holds high the score. Howells said the texts are immemorial reflections upon the transient griefs and indestructible hopes of mankind. And it's such an impressive piece because what Howells is trying to express seems to be wholly at one with his way of expressing it. If you missed it, if you want to hear it again, don't forget, it's on the iPlayer for the next week. The first proms performance of Howells' Hymnus Parasidi. Maybe the opening ceremony of the Paralympic Games tonight, but that hasn't stopped a packed Royal Albert Hall. Back come Mia Pearson, Andrew Kennedy, Neville Creed, Stephen Jackson, and Martin Brabbins. Lovely way the choruses always applaud their chorus masters. They must be doing something right. And they've just brought their choruses to their feet. Martin Brabbins does the same with the BBC Symphony Orchestra. Mia Pearson and Andrew Kennedy at the front. Very much the choruses piece, but wonderful the way the two voices float above the chorus sound and have those wonderfully poignant and pertinent interjections of their own. Well, Howells grew up living and breathing Elgar, who himself had grown up in the same kind of countryside near the River Severn as Howells, and it influenced him just as much. After the interval, the BBC Symphony Orchestra and Martin Brabbins assail Elgar's magnificent First Symphony. But for the next 20 minutes here on Radio 3, we hear words about Elgar as we head down the steps to the Royal College of Music to join Susan Hitch and her guests.
Hello and welcome to this evening's Literary and Musical Proms Plus. The filmmaker and writer John Bridcutt is here talking about the surprising Elgar, contradictory, romantic, not so enthusiastically nationalist, that he found in making his award-winning documentary film. And we're joined by the actor and writer Simon Woods, You may remember him from the series Rome, or more appropriately here, as the quintessentially English young doctor in Cranford. He'll be reading. John, your documentary is called The Man Behind the Mask, but watching the succession of portraits in it, I thought it could have been called The Man Behind the Moustache. The moustache, which seemed both an expression of this larger-than-life public persona and a positive thicket to hide behind. What were the differences between the public and the private Elgar?
That's a big question. I think that there is one particular photograph which really captures that difference between public and private, because Elgar was such a self-publicist that he had all these photographs taken, which were very self-glorifying, really. But there's this wonderful picture of him in a striped jacket with a hat on, sitting on the floor, smoking. And he looks really bohemian. And I think it's really interesting because on the one side, I would say the private Elgar was a very nervous man. But that was true of his public appearances as well. But he was a romantic, and he was an artist. And he sort of spent a lot of time being part of the establishment and being the sort of looking a bit like a retired military figure. And that was all a pose. He did it deliberately, and in a way, he damaged his own reputation substantially by being like that.
Well, certainly in the long term. Let's hear a description of him. Here's Rosa Burley, who was his friend and later his biographer, in 1891, meeting the new violin teacher at the school she ran in Malvern. Simon.
A tall, slight young man with a pale face and dark eyes rose hastily and rather awkwardly from the piano and stood scowling at me. Clearly the interruption was not welcome. Feeling rather chilled, I told him my name and said that I hoped his pupils were working satisfactorily. This elicited some sort of mumbled reply, which struck me as, if anything, more hostile than his silence. He then stood blinking at me for what seemed a very long time, until my struggle to think of some further contribution to this not very promising conversation was mercifully interrupted by the arrival of a pupil. Somewhat deflated, I withdrew.
Thank you, Simon. We'll be meeting Elgar blinking again later. But John, you know, this isn't the confident and smooth public Edwardian we know from photographs, is it? Why does it matter? Why is it important that we should know the private Elgar?
Because I think it's absolutely the key to his music. And this is the trouble, that the image that he portrayed of this very confident man has perpetuated the idea that his music is sort of imperialistic, jingoistic. And, of course, the music is pulsating, if you listen for it, with nervous energy. And the First Symphony is a classic example of that. It's got, certainly, at times, it has a sort of Edwardian swagger. But if that's all you hear, you're missing so much of it. And I think that trying to understand a composer's life and a composer's mentality is the key to understanding the music. If otherwise, you're just sort of you're listening to it blindfold, except with earplugs.
Rosa Burley's violin teacher's 34, and actually at 34 he's still struggling to make ends meet. He's still in obscurity. It's the Enigma Variations, almost 10 years later, that made his musical name. And each Enigma is a portrait of a friend, and they're expressive, they're accurate. He knew his friends, they're telling. They're more expressive than he could be in words. What came between the two?
Well, a lot of oratorio. Enigma was, I suppose, his first major orchestral piece. And you'd had the Froissart Overture many years before, which is a fine piece. But a lot of the music was episodic, and indeed the Enigma Variations mm-hmm. are episodic mm-hmm. in a way. And it's not until you get to the First Symphony that he's really testing himself as a composer. Because all the oratorios, which he got into because that was what you did as a composer in Victorian England. Yes. And it was Ernest Newman, the critic, who said, Elgar must stop writing these oratorios. There was talk of a third oratorio after The Apostles and the Kingdom, The Last Judgment. He said, you've got to find new inspiration, a new idiom, by turning... He said, you're riding on the post-haste on the road to nowhere.
But he was also post-haste on the road to some kind of social success, because he needs to get to orchestras and away from amateur choirs, doesn't he? How does he make that move? Marriage? Better jobs? What happens?
Certainly he marries well. He marries the daughter of a major general. She always felt that she condescended to marry him because he was a cut below her. And, you know, some members of her family never forgave Alice for doing this. He was a Catholic to boot, which didn't go down too well. And so he was struggling to get into the right circles in that way. But I suppose that concert, the Enigma Variations in London in 1899, was a watershed. And that's when he really sort of, after years of being performed out in the provinces, he suddenly made his name.
Mm. There's one tune of Elgar's, I think, that's become part of the national psyche. And it's the slow movement of the first of the pomp and circumstance marches. He wrote to a friend at the time, "I've got a tune that'll knock 'em flat." He knew he did. It's, of course, Land of Hope and Glory. It's the last night of the proms every year, and it made him a national figure. Did he at that point put this kind of doubt and division behind him and become his swaggering self?
I don't know that it was then. I mean, I think the business of writing marches was something that that composers of that time did. I mean, look at, you know, after all, Mahler wrote quite a lot of marches in his music. I don't think there was a moment where he thought I must be more swaggering. I think it was always there, but I think, if anything, it was the other side of him that came through later as he got more confident about his musical expression. And, you know, the other big tune, the great beautiful tune, his wife called it, was the genesis of the First Symphony.
Absolutely. In 1908, when it was first performed, we're going to hear how Jaeger, his good friend and publisher, reacted to it. I mean, Elgar was by this time a national and international star. And Jaeger was there at the first performance in London. Simon, let's hear his account of it.
"I never, in all my experience, saw the like. The hall was packed. Any amount of musicians I saw, Parry, Stanford, Edward German, Percy Pitt, the atmosphere was electric. After the first movement, Elgar was called out, again, several times after the third, and then came the great moment. After that superb coda, the audience seemed to rise at Elgar when he appeared. I never heard such frantic applause after any novelty, nor such shouting. Five times he had to appear before they were pacified. People stood up, and even on their seats, to get a view."
Simon, thank you. Some people love success. Not everybody does. It came very late to Elgar, didn't it? How did he react?
Well, he was clearly very gratified because he knew that he'd taken a huge step forward in his own composition, in his own composition ability. And that symphony was indeed successful because it had something like 100 performances in the first year, though it must be said that 22 of them were by Beecham, who cut the first movement in half. So whether that actually counts, I'm not quite sure. But he also knew it was going to be successful because he cut a very good deal with Novello's, his publisher, by insisting that as well as hiring out the parts for a fee, he would charge a composer fee, which apparently they'd never done before. So this he knew that he was onto a good thing. I think he was always rather resentful of the fact that one of his other very famous tunes, Salut d'Amour, he'd sold for something like £3 and given away all the rights, and he kept on hearing street musicians playing it and walking past and thinking, "I'm not getting a penny for that."
Did he find composition easy? I mean, was he a difficult writer? What did he need to make him a composer?
I don't know that he was a lazy man, so he found it easy in the sense he always found it much easier to go and do something else, play golf, go to the races, whatever. And his wife was the real driving force who compelled him to get back into that study and work. I mean, she was literally kept his nose to the grindstone.
But it wasn't always his wife who was in the study, in his thoughts at least, when he was writing, was it?
Well, that's true. I think probably his wife was quite an inspiration at first, but she became the sort of the taskmaster. And Elgar was always a flirtatious man. I think that's what one can deduce from the way that his life worked out. He had this muse is putting it perhaps at its most polite. This lady who was the wife of a Conservative MP, Alice Stewart Wortley, who he'd met in the 1900s socially, and then she became a real, I think it's probably not too strong to say, a flame for him. At the end of that first decade of the 20th century, when he was writing the violin concerto and he'd got really stuck and was on the point of abandoning it, when he, I think they had tea, and he got inspired by her and called her Windflower as her nickname. And this was a lifelong friendship. His wife knew all about it. They sometimes socialized together. But there was clearly a sort of private language going on between them. And the interesting thing is that her letters, fortunately, her letters to him survive, although some of them have been cut, you know, been bits of it cut out with scissors, I think by Windflower's daughter, who felt they were too embarrassing to survive. But none of Windflower's letters to Elgar survive, or hardly any. And this is interesting because he kept everything meticulously. But those letters he destroyed, and that, one presumes, is because it was a bit more than an inspiration.
So we have a portrait of somebody who is full of contradictions, somebody who is respectably married, looking to have a position in a society, this Elgar we know, and who has a kind of deeply romantic underside that he's keeping secret, if not repressing. He's come from a very ordinary background. He's a violin teacher, and now he's a knight of the realm. He's immensely successful, and he's very proud of it. Is this the origin of this kind of irony, the edginess in his music that you've started to talk about? Or is there a kind of inner psychic core to it?
The music is full of that, even in some of the most sort of tub-thumping tunes. The Land of Hope and Glory has a sort of pull between major and minor, which is really intriguing. And it's not, you know, there's a sadness to it and a poignancy. And that is the key, of course, to understand. You're on the edge the whole time with Elgar. And that's what I think we've come to understand with his music in the last 20 years or so. Maybe it was understood in his own lifetime, towards the latter period of his life. People said that he was, there was a mask there and he wasn't revealing his true self. But in between, we've been beguiled by his own image.
Because there's a distinct decline in his life. Simon, will you read us Rosa Burley's account from 1920, when his wife dies after 30 years of marriage? And here's some Rosa Burley's account of it.
Oh, there's no doubt that her death, after 31 years of their married life, came as an overwhelming blow to him. But it was not in precisely the kind of blow which had been described by most of his biographers. That Alice had devoted her whole life to Edward is beyond question. She really did worship him, with a blindness to his faults, and indeed to his occasional cruelty to her, that seemed almost incredible. But it's equally true that, while relying on this devotion, he was in the first place rather impatient of its blindness, and in the second, uncomfortably guilty over his debt to it. Her death accentuated this conflict in his soul, and left him completely stunned. He had not the largeness of mind which enabled Disraeli to overlook the faults of understanding of the woman whose fortune had established him. The marriage had been in many ways irksome and irritating. Many of the friends whose wealth had dazzled Edward in the later years had barely concealed their contempt for Alice. But Alice's extremely conventional standards of correct conduct had already made an indelible impression on him. And throughout his married life, he had been at immense pains to maintain a facade of married bliss. I have few memories of Edward after this point. It was odd, after nearly 30 years of intimate friendship, to meet him face to face, as often happened at festivals, and to find that I was completely ignored. I can only guess that an overmastering sense of guilt towards Alice led him to shun the society of those who'd been allowed to look behind the facade of happiness, and who were thus regarded as having, in some measure, connived in his disloyalty to her.
Thank you, Simon. Now we're in a later phase. Elgar's music has dropped out of favour quite quickly, actually, after the First World War, and he'd become already the embodiment of a kind of jingoistic, nationalistic, imperial past. And even as an English composer, English in a slightly depressing way, he wasn't those things. You've already explained that he wasn't these things. But if not, why was he so persistently misread and misheard?
Oh, because of his... He wanted that to be the image, and it was a sort of rope that he put around his own neck. And I think that he began to sort of, I suppose, as he got older, he began to lament the passing of his time, and he knew that he didn't belong in the 1920s. And it was only in the 1930s when another woman comes along that he starts to recover himself.
Well, that's right, isn't it? Vera Hockman. Simon, would you read us the letter she wrote to him after his death?
Robin Hill, June the 2nd, 1934. My wondrous being. It would seem strange and unnatural when so many have written their reminiscences, appreciations, eulogies of you. And how many have claimed an intimate knowledge of you when they have known only the reserved exterior, that I, who have loved you best of all, have been silent for all these tragic months. The reason why is obvious to you and me. The thoughts and memories I cherish of you are far too intimate, too expressibly dear to me, to be told to any but our nearest and dearest. Supposing somebody asked me, what was there about Elgar that made his personality so unique, even when in contact with those unaware of the grandeur and magnitude of his creative work? I should reply, he was the only person I have known who was absolutely natural in all his actions, spontaneous and grand and glorious in his supreme egotism. For you were the most self-engrossed, self-enamored person imaginable. Yet you loved yourself in such a lovable way that instead of turning others away from you, your love of yourself was contagious. No wonder you were in love with your brilliant, dazzling self. Ain't I clever? You were too big to trouble to disguise from those for whom you had any genuine regard your admiration of your own stupendous brain, imagination, memory, genius. Any pose of modesty was for the ununderstanding masses. Yes, you were so self-centered that even your kindly acts were often frankly and unaffectedly a form of self-gratification. But you were so dependent on sympathy and understanding and appreciation, that this dependence aroused in one the protective instinct and a sort of tender compassion that anyone so gigantic in intellect should be so childishly dependent on everyday mortals.
Thank you, Simon. John, one more woman on Elgar's personal holocaust, or different? I mean, this is an extraordinary letter. She has a startling knowledge of him and their relationship.
Incredibly,
who was she?
Incredibly penetrating. I mean, what devastating and yet beautiful, sort of tender as well. I mean, she was a violinist. That he was conducting a performance of The Dream of Gerontius, and he'd spotted her in the second violins in this performance, and he asked the leader of the orchestra to introduce him to this lady. So she was sort of brought, after the concert, she was brought so that he could meet her. And he said, I couldn't take my eyes off you. And he said that to her, you know, at their first meeting. I think absolutely incredible. It shows the sort of flirtatious man that he was. Of course, by then, he'd been widowed for 12 years, something like that. But some biographers, I think, have made the mistake of thinking this was just a little flirtatious behavior and that she was a sort of flibbity gibbet. Well, she was far from that. You can tell from that letter.
When Elgar was dying, he was actually working on a third symphony, which he didn't finish. But from listening to what there is of it, do you think it's merely fanciful to say that he was working towards some kind of resolution that was enabled by this relationship?
I certainly think that the symphony was inspired by the relationship. It was energized I'm not saying that he thought, oh, now I'll write a third symphony. He was commissioned by the BBC, as it happens, to write the third symphony. But I think it gave him the energy and the confidence, perhaps feeling that, you know, this young, attractive woman was mesmerized by him in that very knowing way. She knew exactly what sort of character he was, but it's all the things she's talking about, the fact that he needed this, he was dependent on that sort of affection. And I think if he'd only lived another few months with that cancer, he would have completed the symphony.
Thank you very much, John Bridcutt, Simon Woods.
Susan Hitch presented this evening's Proms Plus literary event at the Royal College of Music. The producer was Gavin Hurd. Well, welcome back up those steps to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Handley. And after those readings about Edward Elgar and talk about him, the one work on the programme in the second half of this first BBC Prom of the evening, given by the BBC Symphony Orchestra conducted by Martin Brabbins, is Elgar's First Symphony.
It is a towering masterpiece. I mean, it may be the greatest symphony by a British composer. And when you say that, it's not a light statement, because British composers wrote some fantastic symphonies in the 20th century, you know, the Vaughan Williams, Walton. I think Mahler and Strauss have a big similarity with Elgar's treatment of the orchestra, his orchestration. Some people say that Elgar's a finer orchestrator than both of them, but they all have an extraordinarily refined ear for colour, and that I think is one of the real strengths of this music. You hear sounds, combinations of instruments that one can't imagine, but Elgar did imagine, and I think that puts him on a really high level of incredible inspiration and craftsmanship.
It's a work about which Hans Richter said to the London Symphony Orchestra when preparing the first London performance a century ago, "Gentlemen, now let us rehearse the greatest symphony of modern times, written by the greatest modern composer, and not only in this country." Elgar was 50 when he wrote it. It was Richter who'd given him the idea and to whom he dedicated it as a true artist and true friend. If you compare the symphony with, say, Mahler's Seventh and listen to the more abrasive and personally expressive moments in Elgar's work, which he deliberately opposed to the noble theme which dominates the symphony, he seems perhaps surprisingly close to the cutting edge of the avant-garde of his time. All the more remarkable then that it made it an immediately triumphal progress round the world with 100 performances in its first year of life. In Britain, the stability and security of the British Empire, which had been a given for decades, was seen to be beginning to fray round the edges. People were becoming uneasy at what the future might hold. And Elgar, with his sensitive artist's antenna, was reminding people just what Edwardian England had to lose. The composer himself said of his symphony, "There is no programme beyond a wide experience of human life, with a great charity or love, and a massive hope in the future." Whatever he was driving at, audiences clearly understood the resonances. The symphony's in four movements, with the second, a scherzo, and the following slow movement played without a break. And tonight, looking at the platform, well, we have that row of 8 double basses, Vienna Philharmonic style, at the back of the platform, facing out into the auditorium. According to Martin Brabbins, that was how Bolt liked to do it, and indeed Elgar himself. So those of you trying to visualise it, it's the double basses right at the back under the bust of Sir Henry, and the organ with the horns next to them and the percussion. And below them is the timpani and the lower wind, clarinets, bassoons, trumpets, trombones and tuba, just the flutes and oboes on the lowest of the little risers, and then on the floor, of course, the strings, divided violins, first and second, opposing one another. And back comes Martin Brabbins onto the platform here at the Royal Albert Hall to conduct the BBC Symphony Orchestra in Elgar's First Symphony.
Thank you.